rooms, and a small portable turntable sat next to them. There were white archival boxes, and colored and clear bins, and wicker bins, everything precisely labeled. Makeup, hair supplies, jewelry, school supplies, miscellaneous dresser contents. Dozens of these. Sitting around and among these things were knickknacks. A stuffed Snoopy doll, a pink rotary telephone, a small figure of a monkey, a lumpy Pottery Bud vase. And all over there were turtles. A large stuffed one, a pillow, a print, an oversized ceramic figurine of one, as big as a stuffed animal. My parents kept all of Sabrina's things in boxes, she said. They tucked them away in the attic. When I got them, I brought them out and gave them a space of their own. I know it may be odd to keep these things, but it comforts me. I come in here sometimes to sit and read. I feel close to her in here. This room was Sabrina Abbott, right down to her hairbrush and her erasers. She looked at the spines of the books. Sabrina was certainly a serious reader. There were two shelves of paperback classics, textbooks on psychology and history, with a few romance novels sprinkled in for good measure. Part of me has always wanted to organize them by color and size, Allison said. But I'm a librarian. I can't do that. Here. She indicated the top shelf of one of the bookshelves, which had about half a dozen small notebooks. She took one of these down carefully. There was a picture of Snoopy and Woodstock on the cover, along with 1977 in large cartoon print. Her last diary, Allison said, opening it with care. The last one I have, anyway. Look at this. She laid a hand over the actual entry, leaving a list exposed at the bottom of the page. Piano, 1 hour, 15 minutes. Calc, 50 minutes. German, 45 minutes. Physics, 30 minutes. History, 45 minutes. She wrote it down every night, Allison said. How much homework she did that day. I've read these diaries so many times I have them memorized. She withdrew the book and set it back in its place on the shelf. You were asking the police about the last diary, Stevie said. It's my holy grail. I'd do anything to get it back. It would be a picture of her during those last months. It would feel like talking to her again.
And it wasn't with her things?
We got everything from her bunk and it wasn't there. If the police don't have it, I mean, I still think they may have had it at some point and lost it. The investigation, if you can even call it that, was a mess. But if they don't have it, my guess is that she hid it somewhere and it was lost. She told me that the kids in her bunk were nice, but they went through her things, played with her makeup, things like that. She may have stashed it somewhere that the kids couldn't get to it. A small but bright light illuminated Stevie's mind. She would have to return to it later. There was still much to take in this room. Here's something else, Allison said, removing a small blue plastic box from one of the shelves. She seemed to appreciate the fact that Stevie had a genuine interest in Sabrina's belongings. These are interlibrary loan slips. I found these at the library at the bottom of an old file cabinet. Look at these books, she requested. You can tell a lot about a person from what they read. Even after she graduated, she was still requesting books, getting ready for the fall semester. The last two she requested were in June, A Woman in Berlin and The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. This was my sister's summer reading when she worked at a camp. She studied German and she was pretty good at it, and she always wanted to know why people behave the way they do. She was deciding between majoring in psychology or history. She wanted to work for justice. I keep anything at all I can find of Sabrina's. Sometimes her friends from high school turn up something, a note from class, a picture, anything at all. They know I collect them. It's like I'm putting together a puzzle, but there are an infinite number of pieces. She put the slips back in the box. I'm also an archivist, she added. I come by it honestly, but you see what I mean. Sabrina worked, she studied, she volunteered. I became a librarian because she loved the library,
She took me there, and it always felt like home to me. She consulted her smartwatch. Almost 7:30, she said. If you want to keep talking, you have to come running with me. Stevie absolutely did not run, but she had a lot more to ask, so it seemed that this morning was the day she took it up. She was dressed in black shorts and a black t-shirt, which seemed fine enough. It wasn't the moisture-wicking, professional-grade outfit Allison had on, but it would do. Great, Stevie said. Would you mind if I took some pictures? Just for me? Not for Carson, I promise. Allison considered for a moment, then nodded. Stevie photographed the room from several angles, getting various shots of the shelves. When she was done, Allison closed the curtains before leaving, shrouding Sabrina's things back in protective darkness. Partially, I cope by running, she explained as she stretched against her outside steps. I started running when I was a teenager, and I've never stopped. It makes me feel clear, like I have some control. I run the lake every morning. It's a beautiful view. Allison set off, her gait even, and Stevie followed. It took her all of 2 minutes to become winded and so sweaty that she thought her body would lose every drop of moisture it contained, but she attempted to keep up. Is there anything you remember about that night? She asked. Allison puffed out easy, even breaths. I remember everything, she said, but nothing relevant. I was at home. I was 12 years old. We got a phone call. After that, it was like a nightmare that never stopped. But you never left town? When something horrific happens, you sort of feel like you have to stay until justice is done, which it never was. Stevie found it hard to ask any more questions for a moment as they started circling the lake. She tried to keep up with Allison, who was very obviously slowing her pace for her benefit. They continued on for another 10 minutes or so, Stevie staggering alongside Allison, until she finally slowed to a stop in a break in the trees. She stepped forward, onto a lip of black rock that jutted out into the air. This is Arrowhead Point, Allison said. It's the best view of the lake. I stop here every morning to take it all in. Well, when the weather allows for it, you have to be careful in the winter. She stepped out onto the point. Stevie hesitated behind her. While the point certainly seemed stable and it stretched out about 10 feet, it wasn't very wide, and it had a gentle downward slope as it narrowed to its tip. Stevie took a few careful steps out onto the rock. Once she did, she could see why Allison stopped there. It was a stunning spot. The lake spread out below, winking in the morning sun. The trees wrapped around like a hug. All of Barlow Corners and the camp stretched out below, partially visible through the trees. Allison rolled her shoulders, and Stevie managed to catch her breath enough to continue her questions. From everything I've heard, Stevie said, it seemed like Sabrina was kind of the odd one out that night. That's what everyone says, Allison replied, sitting down on the rock to stretch her legs. That's the standard line. What was good girl Sabrina Abbott doing out there? But that part never confused me. She was having fun, that's all. She'd earned it. She was an incredibly hard worker. But she was also an 18-year-old kid in the 1970s, which were a really loose time. She broke up with her boyfriend right around then, right? Stevie asked. She did, Allison said. Sean. Why did they break up, do you know? It was a normal teenage breakup, Allison replied. Sean was the kind of person who might go somewhere for college, but then he'd come home, get married, do exactly what his parents did. Sabrina was moving to New York City to go to Columbia in the fall. She was so excited about her new life. Looking back on it, I can see what happened. He was always around, always really nice, but around a lot. He was like an older brother to me. I was really upset when they broke up. Did you ever think that it wasn't Sean? Allison cut in. It's true that Sean never gave up. I think he was convinced that Sabrina was going through some phase and that she would come back. He wasn't supposed to be working at the camp that summer. His family had an outdoor sports business. They rented canoes and kayaks, things like that. He was supposed to be working there, but when Sabrina broke up with him, he got a job at the camp. That really wasn't weird. Everyone worked at the camp. If he wanted to be with his friends, that was the place to be. It was an unwelcome surprise for Sabrina, but he never bothered her. Sean was a lovesick kid, but a nice one. He wouldn't have touched a hair on her head. And he was in all night with Paul Penhale anyway. Do you think Todd Cooper hit Michael Penhale? Absolutely, she said without a moment's hesitation. Why would your sister hang out with someone who did that? Allison sighed deeply. I think she must have thought he didn't do it. Sabrina was really principled and really smart. Maybe it was too horrible to believe that someone you knew could have done something like that. Sabrina was smart, but she was also young and she thought the best of people. Do you think what happened to Michael Penhale had anything to do with the murders, though? That, she said, I don't know. Allison stretched out one last time to reach for her toes and stood. I'm going to finish my run, she said. I don't know if you... I may walk back to your house, Stevie said as casually as she could. Get my bike to get back to camp. Allison smiled and nodded, then continued on her way, picking up her pace. Stevie was unsure what to make of her morning with Allison, but at the very least, she now had an idea about how to focus her time here. She had a plan. 13. After another hot and exceedingly sweaty bike ride, much of which was down the edge of the road while cars whipped past her, Stevie turned down the drive to Sunny Pines. She dropped the bike in the bike rack, wiped her face on the edge of her t-shirt, possibly flashing some other counselors in the process, and hurried over to the dining pavilion for breakfast. It was good that most of her t-shirts were black. They hid the heavy sweat marks all over her torso. Unlike Ellingham, which was up in the mountains of Vermont and in session during the cooler months, everything about camp was moist in the heat. Her body? Moist. Her clothes? Moist. Her shoes practically stuck to the ground. Her towels were always damp. Her hair was never really dry. The constant tackiness gave the bugs something to stick to. The first thing she noticed was that the camp as a whole seemed to have vanished. There was a man on a riding mower preparing the fields, and a few people were in the dining area cooking, but otherwise, no one. This was good for her current purposes, which were getting to her cabin and getting a shower before anyone saw her, or more important, smelled her. The cabin was still secure. The camera app alerted her that she was approaching, so that was working. The big surprise was there to greet her in the morning sunshine. Surprise, she said back to it. She pulled off her disgusting clothes and tossed them into her empty suitcase that she decided would serve as a hamper. Janelle had brought a pop-up laundry basket for this purpose because she was Janelle, and Janelle planned her moves in advance. No shower had ever felt as good as the fresh air shower she had that morning, despite the fact that something was definitely moving around under the stall. When she emerged, clean and fresh, the camp was still silent but for the birds and the mower in the distance. She walked over to the art pavilion, where Janelle was up on a chair, hanging a mobile from a beam. Where is everyone? Stevie asked. They went on a hike around the lake. I thought about going, but I need to get this done. Stevie looked around the art pavilion. It was a concrete shell structure with three walls and a peaked roof, full of tables and chairs and cubbies and shelving for art supplies. The only private area was a room in the back to secure things when they were out of use. Janelle had already transformed it from the blank, rough space it had been to a cheerful, insta-ready fantasia of crafting glory. She had made sample crafts of many types: jars full of colored sand, pot holders, woven bracelets, hanging ornaments made of colored beads, and had set up all the necessary supplies around them like a fancy store display. There was chalkboard paint, Janelle said, hopping down from the chair. I got permission to spray the back door and use that as a bulletin board. I'm doing that this afternoon. This morning I was organizing the back office. There was a ton of crap in there. You don't have to do that, Stevie said. You know you have a problem, right? I can quit anytime I want. How was it? Weird, Stevie said, sitting down in one of the child-sized chairs. but informative, but weird. Allison has a kind of museum of her sister's things. She kept everything of Sabrina's. Everything. Brushes, little slips of paper. But I get now why she wants the diary so much. So I've decided to focus on getting the diary for her. I'm not sure it gets the case anywhere, and it's a long shot. But I guess finding diaries is kind of my thing. This was true. At Ellingham, Stevie had located the diary of a student from the 1930s, which was hidden in a space in the wall. Something that Stevie said made Janelle lift her chin in interest. She turned on her heel and walked into the room in the back. Stevie could hear her shifting boxes along the concrete floor. She emerged a minute later holding one, which she set on one of the tables. "This one has loads of old paperwork in it," she said, removing the lid and pulling out handfuls of loose, dog-eared paper in a variety of colors and conditions. "Just order forms and things like that, but I feel like I saw..." Janelle shuffled through the box until she found what she was looking for and passed it to Stevie. It was an old pink piece of paper. "It caught my eye because of the name," she said, "but I put it back because it's nothing." Stevie took the paper and examined it. "Extra Supply Order Form. Requested by Sabrina Abbott, June 20th, 1978. Paints. Water coolers. A Kickilks, $60. Pencils and brushes, $50. Ceramics. Ring boxes, earring stands, cats, dogs, cookie jars. Trash can. Turtle. Teddy bear. Roller skate, $28. String. Leather. Cloth, $18. Total, $156. "So much crafting, so cheap," Janelle said wistfully. "I mean, adjusted for inflation, it's more, but I want to imagine it is this cheap for a second." Stevie examined the piece of paper in her hand. It was nothing special. A faded old supply list from a box of useless paperwork. "How did they do anything with typewriters?" Janelle went on. "When they made a mistake, it was like, I guess that's just how it's going to be. Everything must have taken forever. Anyway, do you think Allison would want it?"
"Yeah," Stevie said. "I do."
"What about our problem?" Janelle said. "Any brainwaves on that?"
"No," Stevie shook her head.
"But whoever it was has been leaving our cabin alone, which is good." Leaving our cabin alone. The cabins were empty right now. Everyone was out. Stevie took out her phone and pulled up the digital files that Carson had sent to her. "Map of the camp in 1978, she said. "It's in here somewhere." She flicked through the folders and documents before finding what she wanted. "Carson, you magnificent weirdo," she said. "You scanned everything. Where's the camp map? They had been given printed copies the day before in their welcome bags. She had folded hers up and shoved it in her bag. She pulled it out and compared the two. "Sabrina was in the Sparrow Bunk," Stevie said, glancing between the documents. "Sparrow Bunk was 14. What is it now? Here. Pandas." If there was ever a good time to have a look in another bunk, this was probably it. She knew where all the counselors were, and there were no kids around yet. Everything was quiet. "I'll meet you over at lunch," she said to Janelle. The cabins were all identical, and there were over 20 of them, so even with the map, things got a little confusing. She soon found herself at the Panda bunkhouse. She bounced up the four concrete steps to the doorway. The heavier door was open, and the screen door was unlocked. She could see there was no one inside and no one around. She entered the cool cabin, which was considerably larger than where Janelle and Stevie were staying. 8 camp beds were all lined up and ready to go, with colorful cubbies and hooks for the campers' supplies. An overhead fan beat the afternoon heat away without much enthusiasm. But this cabin was under tree cover and cool enough without it. Like Stevie and Janelle's cabin, the screened windows here were high and covered by the same metal grates attached from the inside. At the back of the room, there was a plywood wall. There was a doorway in the middle marked by a green privacy curtain.
Stevie stepped into this area, which was darker and smaller. The counselor who would be staying here had dropped off a red suitcase and a large gym bag, along with several shopping bags worth of supplies. Stevie maneuvered around these, careful not to touch them. She felt the thin partition wall. It was a single layer of wood. She ran her hands along the outer walls, felt around the cubbies. Nothing. She took several pictures, getting the bunk from every angle. The floor was slightly more interesting. This cabin had a wooden floor. It felt to Stevie like there was nothing between the planks and the solid concrete the cabin rested on. But she got down on the floor and knocked, making sure all was solid. She crawled around, knocking and checking, picking at the boards with her fingers. Nothing gave.
"What are you doing?" said a voice.
Stevie jerked her head up and saw a red-headed girl standing in the doorway of the partition wall, a phone clasped to her head and a horrified look on her face. Stevie could hear the person on the other end of the phone saying,
"What? What?"
"There's someone crawling on the floor of my bunk," the girl said into the phone. "Hang on." "Oh, hey," Stevie said. "Sorry, I'm looking for something." It was true, and she had no other excuse ready at hand.
"In my bunk? On the floor? Who are you?"
"I'm Stevie. I got here yesterday, and I came in here by accident, and I dropped my, a key."
"Hang on," the girl said into the phone.
"Hang on."
"So you were in here and you lost a key?"
Stevie nodded lamely. The girl clearly didn't believe her, but at the same time couldn't seem to figure out why Stevie might be lying. She looked at her things, which had not been disturbed.
"It's not here," Stevie said, getting up and brushing off her knees. "Sorry, I got the cabins mixed up before, and I must have dropped it somewhere else. Sorry to bother you. I'll see you later."
Stevie left as casually as possible, which was really not casual at all. She felt the girl's eyes on her back. Her lie had been okay at best. What was she supposed to say? "Don't mind me. I'm just a weirdo who creeps into your bunk while you're gone and crawls around on the floor by your bed. Why am I doing this? Oh, because of the murders." She decided to skip lunch even though she was hungry. She didn't want to immediately face the red-headed girl again. She texted Janelle and asked her to bring a hot dog and soda to the cabin, where she was going to hide for a while with the door closed. The red hair made Stevie think of Diane McClure, who in many ways was the least documented victim. She wasn't as bad as Todd, as good as Sabrina, or the well-meaning drug dealer who almost made it to safety. She was simply there, the girlfriend, the fourth victim. Stevie flopped onto her bed and picked up her tablet, paging through the files until she got to the very short one allocated to Diane. There was an excerpt from a book on the case about her. Very few people had much to say about Diane McClure. Her school records show that she was a middling student, barely passing many of her classes, but not quite failing out. She belonged to no clubs. Her yearbook photo shows a black and white image of a heavily freckled girl with a strange smile that looks neither happy nor sincere. Her thick red hair is long and straight, but the photo cannot capture how vibrant it was in life. Diane was the daughter of lifetime Barlow Corners residents Douglas and Ellen McClure. Her parents met at Liberty High in the 1950s, marrying in 1956. Her brother Daniel was born in 1958, and Diane was born in 1960. In 1965, they purchased the Dairy Duchess, a local diner, from its owners. They would run the diner well into the 1990s. Diane worked there in the evenings and on weekends. "Diane liked to have fun," said friend Patty Horn. "She loved Led Zeppelin and Kiss. She loved going to concerts. She pretty much always wore a shirt from some band or other. That's so much of what I remember about her. Her red hair and her t-shirts from concerts. She had really strong feelings about which albums were acceptable listening. She was passionate. God, she loved Led Zeppelin so much." This was a time when high schools had smoking lounges, and Diane spent a lot of time in the one at Liberty High. Some of the only photos of her in the 1978 yearbook show her leaning out the window, cigarette in hand. Diane began dating Todd Cooper early in their junior year, and by the end of senior year, they were considered one of the leading couples of Liberty High. But they were not king and queen of the prom material. "Diane was too much of a badass for that," said another friend. "When I think of what happened that night, one thing that I always think is, Diane must have put up one hell of a fight. Whatever happened, she went down swinging." Stevie stared at the ceiling for a moment. Had Diane gone down swinging? Had any of them? She paged through the file that detailed the injuries. Carson might have had some unfortunate quirks, but he put together a solid set of case files. She got to the diagrams of the bodies with the detailed notes. Todd, Diane, and Eric had head wounds. Todd was stabbed 16 times, Diane 9. Only Sabrina had no head wound, and Sabrina was the only one noted for having defensive marks on her hands. What this seemed to mean to Stevie was that Diane, Todd, and Eric were all struck, possibly to incapacitate them. In Eric's case, he wasn't struck hard enough, and he managed to run. Sabrina, again, was the odd one out. Maybe this was because she was the least threatening and didn't need to be hit on the head. Whatever the case, one of these things was always not like the other. Sabrina Abbott, again, the perfect girl, the special one, reaching up, fighting back the knife. Stevie jumped as the cabin door opened. "Look who I found," Janelle said, coming in with Nate, whose shirt was soaked through with sweat. She passed Stevie a hot dog and a Coke. "I'm not going to be popular," Stevie said. "Don't ask questions." Neither of her friends seemed surprised. 14. The rest of that afternoon was a free one, and according to Nate, most of the counselors were going over to the public side of the park to go swimming and cook out. Nate and Stevie attempted to dodge this, but Janelle managed to convince them that some kind of effort had to be made to ingratiate themselves with the people they would be spending the summer with. The counselors of Camp Sunny Pines set out in a formless parade, people walking in random groups toward the road that separated the camp from the public park. Once you crossed, there was a thick wall of trees and a great deal more shade. The ground was gnarled with roots, so in places the path was raised up on slatted wooden walkways and tiny bridges, before twisting and splitting into dirt and wood chip paths, staked with trail markers. Janelle, Nate, and Stevie followed along as the group meandered down the path marked in red, which led down and around the water's edge. Stevie found that she was getting a bit winded from the walk and realized they had been going up a slow and steady incline, which then dipped down sharply to get to the water's edge. The trees opened up, and there was a big parking lot in the distance, fairly full of cars. Some RVs and tents dotted the area. The journey ended at a small sand and dirt beach, bordered by rocks and reeds. On the Sunny Pines side, the ground had been cleared for the camp. Here, all was still wild, and the trees and reeds clustered around the lake like a halo. The lake was wide here, and Stevie finally saw the falls that gave it its name. It wasn't quite a wonder, but it was impressive enough. This side of the lake was the real deal. Their little lake below was the spillover, the children's pool. On this side, the green and blue dragonflies ruled the waves, or the ripples. They buzzed the water's surface like drones. Stevie wasn't sure if dragonflies bit, so she shirked away when they landed nearby, twitching their many wings. This was definitely where the snakes hung out. Across the lake, a rock jutted up like a big angry tooth high above the water. It looked like something Jurassic, or like one of those views from exotic vacations where people would dive into crystal waters below, except in this case, any jumpers would have gone into the brackish water of Lake Wonderfalls, or perhaps into one of the smaller rocks tucked in below it. The heat was thick and humming, enough that the lake looked inviting despite the lily pads and dragonflies and thousands upon thousands of snakes Stevie was certain were slithering around them. Many of the other counselors had brought over inflatables, which they pumped up and used to float out on the water. Others jumped off the short dock. Only a few lingered on the side like Nate and Stevie.
Janelle, being a social creature, immediately started chatting with two girls who had brought a large inflatable unicorn raft. She took off her cover-up and got into the water with them, her bright yellow bathing suit making her easy to spot. Dylan, Nate's new co-counselor, was having someone take pictures of him doing backward falls off the dock into the water.
"He's trying to become an influencer,"
Nate said grimly. "It's nice that you guys have something in common," Stevie replied. Nate gave her a long side eye.
"It's only for a few days," she said.
"Easy for you to say."
Stevie sighed and looked around, debating with herself whether to try to swim. Her relationship with swimming was much like her relationship with biking. She'd done it as a kid. In the case of swimming, she'd never learned how to do it properly. She didn't have a solid crawl, and she didn't do laps. Her move was a kind of doggy paddle mixed with a fervent thrashing and treading, but it kept her afloat. Still, it was too hot not to at least try. She got up and pulled off her t-shirt, revealing the old bathing suit she'd gotten at Target a year or so before. It was a hair too small, riding up her butt and cutting into the tops of her thighs. At first, the water was pleasant and the ground sandy under her feet. By the time she got knee-deep, she felt the first wave of chill. She braved a bit farther because running out of the lake when you were in up to your knees was a bad look. The ground dipped away and was replaced by a tangle of slime. The temperature dropped at once, and she was suddenly up to her mid-torso in cold swampland. She flailed a bit, her feet finding only slimy rocks. Her head filled with images of underwater snakes and strange creatures. She felt something brush her ankle, and that was the end of that. She lurched back in the direction of the beach, which was only about 10 feet away. It made her struggle to return less than heroic.
"That looked fun,"
Nate said as she flopped down next to him.
"So you don't like to swim?"
"I swim,"
he replied, not looking up from his phone.
"I'm really good at it. Captain of my junior high team, varsity my freshman year."
"Shut up," Stevie said, reeling.
"It's true. I stopped because I don't like competing, but I swim really well. But that,"
he nodded out at the expanse of lake in front of them,
"looks cold and gross. I like pools. They're managed."
"How come you never mentioned this before?"
"Never came up," he said.
"We once spent the night in the pool house at Ellingham."
"Not to swim, though," he replied.
The concept of Nate the athlete was so astonishing that Stevie found she had nothing more to say. People could be surprising, and that unnerved her. She wanted to believe she could see to the bottom, spot the hints. But she had never so much as suspected that Nate was a secret champion swimmer. She had failed this one. Dylan and some others came out of the water and sat down not far from them. The gesture was entirely normal and friendly. They were making an effort to be social. Stevie knew this and even appreciated it on some level. On another level, though, and one closer to her surface, she shied away from such approaches. She was never sure why. It's not like she had trouble talking to people. Maybe it was more the fact that her parents had always pushed her in that direction, told her to make friends, as if the quantity of friends somehow determined your worth. She already had friends, Nate and Janelle. She was with one of them now. So instead of looking at the new people, she looked over at the imposing rock on the other side of the lake.
"That's point 23,
Dylan said, following her gaze.
"They call it that because 23 people have died jumping off of it."
"It wasn't 23 people," said a girl.
"People have died, but not that many."
"It's 23,
Dylan repeated.
"Why else would they call it that? I jumped it last summer. It was awesome."
"You're an idiot, Dylan," the girl replied. "Besides, if you get caught jumping off that rock, they kick you out of camp." She snapped her fingers dramatically. "Like, you're gone."
"Raptured,"
Nate said in a hushed whisper. The girl wrinkled her nose, indicating that the joke was not all it could be. It was time to turn the conversation to something more Stevie's speed.
"Do people ever talk about the murders?"
Stevie said. The girl poked out her lower lip a bit in thought. Another girl, dressed in a black bathing suit with black hair and nails to match, leaned in.
Oh, yeah, she said. The box in the woods thing. That was a serial killer from the 70s called the Woodsman. Stevie fought back the urge to editorialize. They caught the guy, the girl went on, wrongly. You can go out into the woods and see where it happened, but there's not much there. I went the first year I worked here. It's really weird. You can still see stuff that was there from when they were murdered. Again, this was not true. Stevie twitched internally.
You know you want to,
Nate whispered. She elbowed him. Perhaps sensing that Nate and Stevie were not the chatty kind, the group talked among themselves. There was a public grill, and several of the counselors had brought over hot dogs. Dylan and that group got some and sat back down to eat.
Hold my camera,
Dylan said to one of the girls. While she did so, he took a hot dog roll and pressed the entire thing into his mouth, squashing it in and making himself gag. Nate watched blankly, too defeated to comment. Stevie, however, was transfixed.
Son of a bitch, she said.
This came out a bit louder than intended and got the attention of the group, including Dylan.
Son of a bitch, Stevie said again, jumping to her feet and scrabbling for her phone.
Not you, she heard Janelle say behind her. Stevie was already marching off toward the parking lot, looking for a clearer phone signal and waiting for someone on the other end to answer her call. Finally, they did.
We have to talk, she said. Now.
15. Stevie chose the place for the meeting. The unused treehouse, the one that was meant to be Nate's home for the summer. His bunk sat ready for his arrival behind a thin wooden wall. Now that she had seen this place, Stevie felt like the treehouse thing was maybe overselling it. It was really a second-level building, accessible via a set of wooden steps, with an open area below for storing excess sporting equipment. Mostly it was a screened-in box with a bunch of empty shelves under the windows, and bench seats that had probably had cushions on them at one point. It was next to a tree, which was likely how it got the name. It was a hot, spidery mess, lit by one ineffectual overhead light. See? Janelle said to Nate when they entered. You're not missing out on much. This had not cheered Nate up. Stevie sat on the least cobwebby window seat and watched the ground below, waiting for her guest. She finally saw him approach, dressed in flowing orange harem pants and a box t-shirt. Carson came up the steps two at a time.
What's going on? He asked. Sounds important.
I know who left the message on our wall, Stevie said. And the box on your path.
Oh, great.
He nodded. But his eyes darted a bit, and he tucked his hands into his slouchy harem pant pockets.
You did, Stevie said.
This much she had already revealed to Nate and Janelle, who looked at Carson with unimpressed faces.
Me?
I wouldn't recommend whatever you're planning on saying, Janelle said, joining Stevie on the window bench.
I would.
Nate was sprawled on the floor, picking at the splinters.
I like it when Stevie goes feral.
To his credit, Carson said no more. He sat down on the floor and crossed his legs in a full yogic knot. Now, will you tell us the how? Janelle said. That's more what I want to know.
Sure.
Stevie stretched out a bit, and her neck made a loud crack. We knew from the start that the message was put on our wall in advance. We know that because it was dry and because there was paint under my bed. Also, we went all over the cabin to see how someone might get in. The screen windows have metal grates over them, the door was locked from the inside, and the floor is made of concrete. Impossible, right? But there was one way. There's a hole in the screen on the window, only an inch or two big. And tonight, when I saw Dylan stick that entire hot dog roll in his mouth, I realized how someone could use a hole that size to gain access to our cabin.
Not what I expected to hear you say, Nate said. But okay.
You can get something large through a small opening if it's soft, Stevie went on. The hot dog roll was soft, so Dylan could shove it in his mouth. So what might go through a little hole in a screen? Maybe something like this.
Stevie held up the reusable bag Carson had given her. She made an okay gesture with her right hand, and with the left, pulled the bag through the circle made by her fingers.
Fabric, she said. And who has a lot of fabric in custom photorealistic patterns?
Oh, no, Janelle said, shaking her head.
Oh, you have got to be kidding me.
There's an entire wall of it at the bounce house, Stevie said. All you'd need to do is make a wood pattern. It was probably up there on the wall. You painted the message on the wall, kind of high up, so it was more in line with the window and more in shadow. You let the paint drip, but not too much, because you had to make sure the message fit under the piece of fabric you were going to use to cover it. You wiped away any extra so it wouldn't show. When it was dry, you covered it up with the piece of fabric, attaching it with some tape. She held up the piece of tape she'd found under the bed. She had gone back and retrieved it before this meeting. All you needed to do then was attach some thread or fishing line or something and string it out the window. Sometime in the night, you gave the string a tug and the fabric slid out through the screen. I think it must have brushed against my face as it came down. I thought what I felt was some kind of insect. And that was it. A message mysteriously appears on our wall. Then, of course, you prepared the box of dolls and claimed to find it on your run.
Yes, he said, breaking into a huge grin. Yes, you, he pointed at Stevie, are the real deal. That was nuts. That was so good. I knew I made the right decision.
Was this supposed to be some kind of test? Nate asked.
I don't think so, Stevie said. It was for the show, wasn't it?
Sometimes you need to prime the pump, Carson said. A little drama to get things going.
And your plan was to freak us out and make us feel like someone was sneaking into our cabin and leaving threatening messages? Janelle said.
You were never in any danger, Carson said.
How did we know that?
But you weren't,
he said a bit less enthusiastically. So the plan was to fake this message thing, and then what? Stevie said. Have it be part of the case? Make it seem like someone was trying to stop the podcast?
Well, yeah, he said. And you didn't think people might be annoyed by that?
Nate asked.
Like, people listening? To know that you faked threats against yourself? Well, the idea was for no one to know.
When were you going to tell us? Stevie said. He reached deep into his messenger bag and pulled out a balled-up bag in a wood pattern.
Have one. It's the bag from the wood pattern in your cabin. I was going to tell you soon because I knew you were alarmed. See, I even brought the bags.
He tossed one to Stevie, who let it land on the ground.
I'm going back, Janelle said, shaking her head. I have to talk to Vi.
She looked to Nate.
Oh, I'm staying,
Nate said, settling in.
This is absolutely my think jam.
Stevie faced off with Carson, who looked altogether too happy for someone she had just busted for leaving creepy messages. He had the glowing contentment of a man who fully believed that he was one with the cosmos, feeling all the feels.
So we're clear, Stevie said. I'll still work on this case, but I do it my way, which means never faking stuff.
No, I've got it.
She held up a hand. I'm doing this on my own, she went on. I'll talk to people.
And then we'll...
He just would not stop.
I'll, she said, tell you if I find anything, but these are real people. Janelle and I are real people. I know you have the money and you own this place, but you don't own this town or their pain. We're supposed to be helping. You're not helping.
If Carson was embarrassed by being dressed down by a 17-year-old girl at his camp, he certainly didn't show it.
I hear what you're saying, he said.
Nate shook his head in warning.
Now you're going to answer some questions, Stevie went on. Were the floors of the bunks always concrete?
This clearly threw Carson for a loop.
Always, he said. In case of flooding, sometimes the lake spills over the banks.
Were they redone or are these the originals?
They were redone, I think, in the 60s.
But they were like this in 1978?
Yep, he said. Why? You think there's something encased in the concrete or something?
No, she said.
Then why?
No, she said again.
Carson shut up. He unfolded himself from the floor.
I made the right decision with you, he said. I was trying to disrupt the narrative, but I promise you, I won't do anything like that again.
Wow,
Nate said when he was gone.
Wow. If you don't want to be a detective, I think you have a future in domination. He's shorter now.
Truth be told, Stevie had enjoyed it. She glowed with warm pleasure.
What was the concrete thing about?
Sabrina's diary, Stevie said. I wanted to know if there was any chance it could have been concealed in the floor. I guess not.
You know there's basically no chance that thing is still around, right? If they haven't seen it since 1978 and have already looked?
I don't know about that, she said. If she was going out into the woods to buy pot, she wouldn't bring her diary with her. It's not like she was going to be sitting out there in the dark writing, Dear Diary, here I am, buying weed for the first time.
No, he said. I guess not. What about in a tree? People do that a lot in books, stash something in a hollow tree.
Possible, Stevie replied. Seems risky, though. It could be destroyed by weather, or someone might find it. You'd want it to be in a safe, dry place that only you knew about.
Okay, what about someone obsessed with the case? Souvenir collectors. If someone found that diary, it would be huge.
True crime people aren't serial killers. They don't want secret trophies. If someone had that diary, they'd want to tell everyone. That's the whole point. Nate nodded in acceptance of this fact.
So it seems like the diary is your main thing now. Is this because you feel like the case itself can't be solved?
I don't know if the case can be solved, Stevie replied. I don't know if I'm the one who would be able to do it if it could be. It's probably going to come down to DNA or something. But looking for the diary is something I can do to help someone who's still around.
You didn't tell Carson that.
Carson doesn't need to know, Stevie replied. Screw Carson.
Agreed. Also, I think it's a good plan. I don't mean to sound like it's not. It just seems like it also might be hard, but less hard than tracking down a serial killer from 1978.
They fell into silence, listening to the chirp of the crickets or the cicadas or whatever it was that chirped all night in the summer. Some kind of chirping thing.
People had so little to do back then,
Nate said meditatively.
Before the internet, I guess you had to keep a diary or something. How else would you remember what happened?
Stevie hmmed.
There will be children here tomorrow,
Nate said.
Children. With their little child fingers.
Child fingers?
I'm saying we won't be safe anymore. This other counselor better stop being sick really quick.
As Stevie walked into her cabin later, Janelle was wrapping up a call with Vi. Stevie could see their short silver hair on the screen and their pink-tinted round glasses. Whatever lovey-dovey talk they were engaged in cut off quickly. Stevie said hello, then went over and flopped on her bed. It was not a particularly forgiving sort of bed, and the springs squeaked in protest. There was a pungent chemical smell in the air, and the message on the wall was gone. You got it off the wall, she said as Janelle finished the call. Yeah, I used some denatured alcohol to soften it, then I scraped it off.
Denatured alcohol?
They use it for camping stoves, so there was some around. The smell will go away soon.
I don't know if I want it to, Stevie replied. That's probably the only thing I'll solve all summer.
She waited for Janelle to jump in and say, no, of course not. Janelle was always encouraging, but she was also realistic. Her silence confirmed Stevie's worries. However, there was something that changed her mood immediately. A text from David popped up on her phone.
Got off work a day early. See you tomorrow.
16. Stevie woke up in a bright and beautiful mood that befitted Barlow Corners. Today, David would be here. Today, she had something she could give to a family member of one of the Box in the Woods victims. Today, the kids were coming. And that seemed wonderful, too. Again, Stevie set out in the morning on a bike. The route to town was easy enough, with only two turns to make. Still, most of the country roads had no bike lanes, no sidewalks. You were supposed to ride along the edge of the street and trust.
She wobbled at times and pumped the brakes anxiously, never really sure if she was about to skid off the side of the road or into traffic. No one else seemed to be having these problems. People on racing bikes whizzed around her, utterly sure of their command of the road. When she arrived in the town center about half an hour later, she was a shattered husk of her former self, but she had grown in her own personal estimation. She rolled the bike up the sidewalk for the last few blocks of the journey and chained it in front of the library. The library air was shockingly cool on skin that was slick with sweat. Allison was in the new reading room, organizing some picture books. She had on a cheerful yellow shirt dress with a matching necklace made of big yellow beads. Janelle would have appreciated the lemony color and the precision.
"Hey," Stevie said quietly.
Allison turned.
"I have something for you," Stevie said, reaching into her backpack and producing the typed paper of art supplies.
"We found it when we were organizing the art pavilion. It was in a big box of junk, but I know you like to have anything Sabrina made or wrote, so..."
Allison stared at the paper, then looked up at her, a strange expression on her face.
"The art pavilion?" she said.
"Yeah, we were cleaning it. Well, Janelle was, and she found this, and I thought..."
Allison turned her gaze back to the paper. Stevie couldn't make out what she was thinking, but there was a lot of movement behind her eyes. Stevie was not great with intense emotions and felt the pull of the exit on her heels.
"I should get going," she said.
"Yes,"
Allison said distractedly.
"Yes."
Stevie was halfway to the library door when Allison hurried up to her and took her gently by the arm.
"Thank you," she said. "That was...
it was kind. Thank you so much."
"It's no problem," Stevie said, because really it wasn't.
"Sabrina was bad at typing," she said. "It was a joke in our family. Sabrina could do everything, but she couldn't type to save her."
Allison reconsidered finishing the sentence, blinked, and reset the conversation.
"How is your research going?"
"Not great," Stevie said. "Most people probably won't talk to us because of Carson."
"They will if I ask," Allison said, her eyes bright. "Who do you want to speak to?"
"Anyone who will talk to me," Stevie replied. "People who were there. Sean Greenvale, Susan Marks, Paul Penhale."
"Do you have to be back right away?"
"Not really."
"Come on," Allison said. "Paul's practice is only a few doors away."
The Barlow Corners Veterinary Hospital was actually four doors down, next to the Pilates and bar studio. It was a brightly colored office, intensely cheerful, with many children's drawings of their pets in crayon, almost all with messages thanking Dr. Penhale for caring for them. There was a coffee station and fresh baked cookies on the side. A man with tidily trimmed gray hair and scrubs covered in cartoon puppies sat behind the desk. Stevie vaguely recognized him from the picnic.
"Hey, Joe," Allison said. "Is Paul in with a patient?"
"He is, but should be done in a second."
As he said that, a door opened and a man in maroon scrubs stepped out, carrying a small curly-haired dog in his arms. The dog looked a little loopy and had a bandage on his ear.
"You can take that bandage off before you go to bed this evening," he said, passing the dog to a woman in the waiting room. "But he's going to have to wear the cone for a week until the stitches heal. And no dog park for a while."
Once patient and owner were checking out at the desk, he came over to greet them.
"Hey, Allison,"
he said, looking between her and Stevie with some confusion.
"What's up?"
"This is Stevie from the event the other night," Allison said. "You remember."
"Hard to forget,"
he replied, but he nodded a polite greeting to Stevie.
"Stevie's okay," Allison said. "It would mean a lot to me if you would give her an interview about the case."
Paul raised his eyebrows in surprise.
"Really?"
"Really," she said. "She's all right."
The owner and the small dog left, and Paul waved his goodbye. Then he turned to the man at the desk, who was typing into a scheduling program with lightning speed.
"Hun, when's my next?"
"You have 45 minutes, the man replied. "Your 10:15 spaying appointment asked to bump to this afternoon."
"Looks like I have some time now," Paul said. "I could use a coffee. That okay with you, Joe?"
"Fine by me," Joe replied,
Gives me a chance to unpack the surgical supplies.
My husband, Paul explained, keeps everything going.
Joe did not deny it. He peered over the desk to regard Stevie.
So the box guy owns the camp now, huh?
He asked. Stevie nodded.
And he also wants to make a podcast about what happened? Seems like a broad remit. Still, I have to admit, I like those boxes.
Stevie shrugged because Joe was right. It was a weird combination of interests.
Joe likes organization,
Dr. Penhale explained.
I joked that he wanted us to take our honeymoon at the container store.
Joe held up his hands, indicating that he was guilty as charged.
So you're set here, Allison said. If you need anything else, you ask me.
With a nod, she exited.
You seem to have made a big impression on Allison,
Paul said.
And if you're all right with Allison, then you're all right with me. Let's walk over to Patty's, get a coffee or a soda or something.
They crossed the street to the Sunshine Bakery. Patty Horn was in the back decorating a cake. She gave a wave but continued with her work as her assistant rang up the coffees and prepared them. Paul insisted on paying. All the tables were empty, so they took the one by the window. Sunshine Bakery was, true to its name, extremely sunny. Sunlight poured in over the cheerful yellow table, decorated with a red Gerber daisy in a jar.
So what can I help you with?
He asked. Do you mind if I record this? Stevie said, getting out her phone. Not for the podcast. For me, just to remember. Paul gave an expansive gesture that indicated she should do as she liked. I guess, Stevie said, and then regretted starting that way. She needed to sound more sure, more confident, but that was easier said than done. She was facing a man who had lost a brother, as Allison had lost a sister, and Patty had lost her friends. Everyone around here had lost, and she felt it in her bones. Paul was waiting. She needed to stop sounding so unsure. Your brother, she said. It was not a question, but Paul seemed to understand. If that's okay, she added. Paul nodded, his chin dipping toward his chest a bit.
It's all right,
he said.
I've been talking about what happened to my brother, about everything that happened here, since I was 17 years old. It's been with me for most of my life. My brother died in December of 1977, about 7 months before the murders. It was right before Christmas. He was in the junior high band. He played the trumpet. They were doing a special long rehearsal for a holiday concert. I was home. I was watching Starsky and Hutch downstairs and doing homework. The phone rang and I heard this scream from upstairs.
He stopped and looked down at his coffee for a moment.
It was our neighbor, Mrs. Campbell, who called,
Paul said.
It happened right around the corner. He would have been home in a minute or two. Someone came around the corner and mowed him down. Mrs. Campbell heard it happen and ran out. She was with him when...
He shook his head.
He didn't die right away. She stayed with him while the ambulance came. He died en route.
And people think Todd Cooper was the one who...
I don't think.
He cut in.
I know Todd Cooper was the one who hit him. Everyone knows Todd Cooper was the one who hit him.
His voice rose a bit and Patty looked up from her cake decorating. Paul cleared his throat a little.
Why don't we step outside?
He asked.
It's a nice morning.
The temperature had climbed even in the short period they had been in the bakery, and Stevie felt herself immediately start to sweat.
This is a small town,
he said as soon as they were clear of the door and any passers-by.
Everybody really does know everyone. And it's not like there are any secrets about what happened with Todd and my brother. Certainly Patty knows all about it. But it always feels best to maybe keep this conversation... Well, I don't know. It's a reflex.
They drifted toward the green and sat down on one of the benches by the statue.
The town felt even smaller back then,
he said.
Everyone was in and out of everyone else's house or yard. We all knew what everyone else was up to. I knew Todd. We were good friends. Todd drove a brown Jeep with a red stripe. He drove fast, with the music up loud. And he drove high. He drove drunk.
Lots of people did back then. Todd did it a lot. I was in the car many of those times. There were near misses that we'd laugh off. That night, it wasn't a near miss. Someone saw him. There was a girl named Dana Silverman who was in band as well. She was walking home from the same rehearsal. She said she saw his Jeep turn the corner of Mason Road and Prospect Avenue right after the accident, and that it was going fast. She even saw the green fuzzy dice he had hanging from the rearview mirror. The next day after the accident, Todd didn't drive to school. He turned up in his girlfriend Diane's car. That had never happened before.
Did anyone ask why? Stevie asked.
I asked Diane why. Lots of people asked her why. She said Todd's dad took the keys because he'd gotten a D on a major test. Like I said, I knew Todd. I rode in that car and I knew all about his life. His dad might have been pissed about a test, but his dad never took his keys.
Didn't the police question him? Stevie said.
The police said they did. He said he was at home all night. His parents said the same thing, said they were all sitting in the living room watching TV.
But they would have looked at the car.
So you'd think,
Paul said, smiling mirthlessly. No one checked the car?
After the accident, the Jeep wasn't in the driveway, where it normally would have been. No one saw that car for a week. And then, after a week,